Hello everyone, I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello everyone, welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host Nate, and today I'm joined by wildlife filmmaker Robert Wedderburn. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Nate.
So, Robert, I want to get started off with how you first got into reptiles and what led you to decide to focus on wildlife filmmaking, especially with snakes.
So, I've been interested in snakes probably my whole life, I would say, since I was about 5 years old or so, as far as I remember. And I'm originally from Durban, South Africa. And I remember when I was 5 or 6 years old, I found a night adder in the garden, and there were a lot of children there at the time. It was at aftercare, so this was just after school, and they were all saying, kill it, kill it, kill it, kill it, kill it, and I thought this was a baby python. I didn't know what it was at the time, but in my mind, I just thought, how could you kill an animal that's doing absolutely nothing wrong? It's just slithering. It's just going through your garden, and it's doing nothing wrong. It makes no sense to try and hurt it. And they took a ball, and luckily they weren't so good at killing the snake, and they took a semi-deflated ball, and they put it on top of the snake, and they all took turns on standing on the snake. And how no one got bitten, I've got no idea. But eventually, after 15 minutes or so of me shouting and trying to get them to stop killing the snake, my mom arrived, and she's a vet. So she's at the moment in Scotland, but she was originally a vet in South Africa. And she said to the kids, you know, you're crazy, you're going to get yourself bitten. And she scooped up the snake and put it in a glass jar. And I took my so-called baby python to the snake park to learn a bit more about snakes. And I found out that the snake was venomous. And probably at that age, at about 5 or 6 years old, if one of us was to have been bitten, it would have been quite painful. And then I learned about, which is probably still my favorite snake, which is the brown house snake. And that's when I got introduced to a brown house snake, and I just thought that snake was incredible. It was just the most beautiful snake in the world. And, you know, you could hold a snake that was so tame, and to me that was just incredible. And then I think I just started learning more and more and more about all different snakes that we had specifically in the Durban region or in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And then I think I started keeping snakes probably about from the age of 6 or 7. So I would say a year or two after that. And I was only allowed to keep that night adder for 1 week because in my mom's point of view was that if it's a venomous snake, then we're going to have to at some stage move it and put our hands inside. And she wasn't happy with her 5 or 6 year old keeping venomous snakes at that time.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. So then after that, I just carried on learning more about snakes and kept brown house snakes. Then I started to get into exotic snakes. Well, I had an egg eater, a common egg eater, a rhombic egg eater. And then, as I think most people go, corn snakes and king snakes and a few different python species, and it just carried on going from there.
Great. So what got you into wildlife filmmaking? What inspired you to do that?
So when I started keeping snakes, I really, really enjoyed keeping them. And when I used to breed snakes, if I bred something, I didn't really want to let it go. I really loved keeping the snakes that I had. And I couldn't imagine having to part with my snakes every year. And I just thought that there were so many snakes that are incredible all around the world, especially in South Africa. And at, you know, around about 19 years old or so, I moved from South Africa to Ecuador, where I am now. And I started working in a zoo there. And I just carried on trying to work with snakes in one way or another. And there wasn't a lot of money, or it wasn't so easy to work with snakes directly. And I started wanting to film a lot of wildlife. And then I thought, well, if I have this knowledge of snakes and I enjoy working with them, why not film them? And why not be the person who tries to portray these animals in a way that isn't so scary, like a lot of the stuff that you see on TV? And I really don't like a lot of the stuff that we see on social media and on television, where they show a lot of, especially venomous species, in a way that, you know, if you've worked with them and you know how they are in real life, they're really not that bad. They're really beautiful animals, and they deserve a lot of respect, but there's no need to be scared of them. So I just started to try and portray them in the best way possible.
Yeah. So what was your first film about?
So when I started filming, I bought a camera for about $250. And I had to make some money with it to convince my parents that this was actually some way that you could make some money. Yeah. So I started filming motocross videos. And the first video that I made was quite spectacular, because I went with a friend to the motocross track, and he actually went around a corner, jumped a jump, and in the middle of the air, all I heard was the throttle going crazy, like something bad was about to happen, and he landed right on top of a sheep.
No.
So that was quite an eventful start. That was my first day filming. And then I just thought, well, you know, if that happened on the first day, imagine what things I'm going to end up filming if I carry on doing this for a longer period of time. So then I just got hooked, and I started doing a lot of BMXing videos and downhill videos just to practice. And then I thought, well, this is not really what I want to do. If I was to make a choice, I would go and film wildlife. So then I moved back to South Africa and I studied to be a film director. And then after 2 years of really not enjoying film school, I had a lot of respect for my teachers and I learned a huge amount, but it just wasn't what I wanted to do. What I really wanted to do was go back to the bush, to be out there with all different types of animals, and not just snakes, just absolutely everything.
Yeah. So do you still do any filmmaking outside of wildlife?
I don't do any filming besides wildlife. So at the moment, what I do is I have a YouTube channel, and I'm a YouTuber, and I have a Facebook page, and I try to put up daily content. And for me, it's migrated to 100% wildlife, and I just don't have enough time to film anything else. And I think that it's very specialized, and there's a lot of other people that are very good at doing all different other genres. So I really just want to focus on wildlife.
Yeah, that's one thing I've heard from other, and I haven't heard this in person, but from other YouTubers, they all mention how YouTube and that sort of stuff really is a full-time job. It's not some easy thing that you can just do on the side when you want feel like it and be successful.
Yeah, and I think that the reason why I wanted to do YouTube, and the reason why I wanted to make this documentary series, which I made a few years ago, which I'm putting up at the moment on YouTube, called Snake Heroes, was because a lot of the videos and the narratives about snakes that I saw on the internet were completely warped from reality. It wasn't what I had experienced. I hadn't experienced black mambas coming towards me or trying to attack me. or even, you know, showing their mouths. It was very easy to work with black wombas in South Africa, very easy to work with Mozambique spitting cobras. And a lot of the shows portray them as something that's scary or difficult to do. And although it's not difficult to work with those snakes, you have to have a lot of respect and you have to be careful. And, you know, things can happen very quickly. But the people who do it every day, like Byron Zimmerman and Nick Evans, are so good at it, they can just walk in and they can be out with that black mamba in 20 seconds. So it's really not hard to do. And what I really didn't like about what I was seeing on TV at the time was that they were portraying them to be dangerous and a danger or a menace to society. And they do so much good for controlling rodent populations and amphibian populations, and we need them. And I'd far rather live in South Africa and have black mambas and Mozambique spitting cobras in my garden than live in New York and have rats everywhere on the streets. So yeah. I just felt that it was my duty to show the people that I call the snake heroes the good work that they do, to show their work and to portray snakes in a positive light so that people want to be curious and want to work with them and want to learn more about them, because I find them fascinating.
Yeah, it's one thing I've always noticed with nature documentaries growing up, is they always portrayed, especially like spitting cobras or black mambas, as being almost malevolent, very, very aggressive, almost malevolent, I would want to say.
Exactly.
Whereas every snake I've ever worked with, yeah, some might not be as well disposed to having the big hairless monkey try to mess with it, but they're not actively chasing you like they're trying to purposely kill you.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And the one thing that surprised me, because I've really never worked with exotics, well, North American species. The only ones that I've ever really worked with on a daily basis were copperheads and nothing really else. And in December last year, I filmed a new series, or season two of Snake Heroes, and that's going to be Snake Heroes Florida or Snake Heroes USA. But at the moment, we're just filming in Florida. And
I was
so surprised how rattlesnakes are so easy to work with. And this is the thing, that on television, they are portrayed to be malevolent, like you say. And everyone is so scared of them. And in real life, they don't even rattle. A lot of them are just so relaxed that you can walk straight past them. And we have the same situation with puff adders in South Africa, that everyone thinks they're going to walk in the bush and they're going to get bitten by a puff adder because they might accidentally step on it. And there's been research, and we know that that's not the case. And we know that puff adders don't want to strike back, even if they're stood on by a human. So really, snakes aren't out to get us. And if they were, a lot more of us would have died a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we mentioned, well, actually, before I forget, what's the name of your channel so people can go find it, watch your videos?
So on YouTube, it's very simple. Well, my name's not so simple, but it's just my name and surname. So Robert Wedderburn. And then on Facebook, it's called Robert Wedderburn Productions. And then on TikTok, I'm Robert Wedderburn.
All right. So now the people who listen, all five of you, know where to find him. So, but speaking of venomous keepers in Florida, that's actually a guy I know down there. His name's Phil Wolf. He hosts a few podcasts, including a Venomous Exchange radio podcast. But I think he also does a little bit of YouTube, like Venomous Etiquette, I think it's what he calls it, something like that. And I have to double check it. But yeah, he's a pretty cool guy, in case you're looking for someone else to talk to.
I'm going to look him up straight after this.
All right. Yeah. So, your first season, was that mostly set in South Africa?
So, Snake Heroes Season 1 was a series that I made about 5 years ago, and I'm putting up the episodes as we speak. So I think we're on episode 3 or 4 on YouTube at this moment. And the idea is that South Africa is full of people that are so knowledgeable about snakes. And a lot of them are so busy doing their work that people don't know a lot about them. Luckily now, because of social media, we get to see the work that they do and we get to communicate with these people. But 5 years ago, a lot of them were unheard of, or people knew them or they knew the name, but there weren't any interviews and good knowledgeable content with these people in it. And I just really got pissed off, I would say, by all the stuff that I saw on TV. And I jumped in my car and I phoned up all of them and I said, we're going to make a documentary. Would you like to be a part of it? I want to interview the best snake experts in Southern Africa, and it's going to be called Snake Heroes. Would you like to be a part of it? And every single one of them said yes immediately, you know, within 5 minutes of asking them, which I was quite amazed about. So by the end of the week, I jumped in my car and I drove all around South Africa and slept on a lot of couches and interviewed who I think are people that we need to pay homage to, we need to know more about, and I want to preserve their points of views on a lot of topics so that people 50 years from now, 100 years from now, can look back and know that people were doing things the right way and they were working hard, and there are people that are very interested in snakes doing amazing work, not just the stuff that you see on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and on TV.
Not the overdramatized stuff, the actual real stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. So before Snake Heroes, did you do any other filmmaking with wildlife?
Yes, I did. So I think I started at about the age of 21, 22. And when I started, it was very hard for me to get from here in the city, in the Andes, I live in Cuenca, Ecuador, to the jungle. It was just impractical. So when I moved to South Africa, I started filming a lot. And I worked for a director, a film director, a film producer. And we used to do a series, a children's series that teaches children about nature. And I filmed for him. And we traveled all over Southern Africa, all over South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, visiting all the national parks, as many as we could, to teach people about nature and about the good that nature can do for children. And if exposed to nature, they can have, you know, change the way that they think about certain things, and they can grow as young humans. So when that happened, I enjoyed that a lot, and I traveled all over Southern Africa, but then I knew all these places and I wanted to go and visit them myself. So I started filming for myself and I started to do a few other film projects. I was commissioned to do a film for Nat Geo and Vice in Saudi Arabia. So I directed a film for them about falconry, which was a bit different from the other stuff that I did. But for me, it was so interesting to go there and travel and learn about their culture, and to learn about what they call a sport, which is the art of falconry, and to learn how they are trying to use this as a bridge to take people from hunting and from a non-sustainable form of the sport to falcon racing. And I thought that was quite interesting. So I wanted to be on board with that project, and I learned a huge amount about how if you change the culture within a certain community, you can really help conservation. So any step forward in my mind is positive. And a lot of people, they have this very pure, idealistic form of what conservation is. And I think that if everyone does their part in a small little way, we're all in the same boat. We have to be, because climate change is happening. Things are are going in the wrong direction at this moment. And if we don't change our tune and we do it a slightly different way, and if we all go a slightly different way, there'll be a big difference. And that just triggered a little bit in my mind, it was a bit of an epiphany for me, because then I thought, okay, I can't go and make Planet Earth. I can't make these big productions. But if I make a small contribution and everyone tries their hardest, then collectively we're making an effort and we're doing good.
Yeah, yeah. So do you do any herping on the side outside of when you're filming? I imagine you probably do, but...
So when I lived in South Africa, I lived in a game reserve on the outskirts of Kruger National Park.
Nice.
Yeah, we had giraffe in our garden that would come and sleep right outside our balcony, and we had to be quiet at nighttime because the giraffe was sleeping. And we had a lizard, a giant plated lizard that we'd go and say good morning to every morning. And we'd go further down, if we'd go and walk our dogs, we'd see all different animals. And if you call that herping, yes, we were looking for snakes every single day.
Yeah, sounds like life to me. Sounds a bit like Swiss Family Robinson almost.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And now I try to go to Florida a lot. The first thing I do is I go to the Everglades, because for me, it's such a beautiful place. And the United States has got so many national parks and so many places that people, I don't know if they really know them. It's a strange thing, because they see all the TV shows and there's a lot of drama and there's a lot of crazy things that they show. And they'll show certain moments with certain species, but they'll focus on things that are you might not see all the time, like bears and the big extreme animals. And yeah. Then I was there, and I think it was a scarlet snake that I saw last week. And for me, that was just so fascinating, because I've never seen one before. So I think when you go herping, if you pick a different place, a place that you're not so familiar with, then it's amazing, because when you see something like here in the Amazon, when you see an Amazon basin emerald tree boa for the first time in the wild, it's like you can't believe that that's real. And no matter how long you look at it, it doesn't seem real. And I think maybe for you, coming from the US, if you were to go to South Africa and if you were to see a black mamba or a Mozambique spitting cobra or puff adder in the wild, for us back home, it would be okay. But I think it would be the same experience to really see what they are like in the wild.
Yeah. Yes. But like, speaking of herps in South Africa, well, Africa and all South America are like the two continents where I would feel the least confident just picking up a snake. I just see it and grab it, because those are the two continents I feel like I'm the least familiar with their venomous outside of their most iconic stuff. It's like, it wasn't until like a year or two ago that I learned South Africa has garter snakes, but they're in a lapid. So,
exactly.
And like, South America has a bunch of different like rear fangs and stuff like that. So if it's not a pit viper, I'm probably not going to mess with it.
Yes. So here in the jungle, I think you have to have quite a lot of confidence to pick up any snakes that are red, black and yellow, red, black and white. And that's exactly how I felt when I saw the scarlet snake in the Everglades. I just left it. I didn't pick it up, and I was fine. I just took a little video and I let it carry on its way. I didn't even touch it, because a lot of it for me is just seeing those species in the wild. I don't feel this conviction to touch them. And it's the same thing when I see a lot of people on social media and they're picking up a snake or they're freehanding a snake. I just don't want to do that. I really, really enjoy seeing them, much like a bird watcher sees birds. And if I see it and it's there and I don't have to touch it, I won't touch it. I'll leave it and it can carry on going.
Yeah. Yeah. So have there been any memorable finds you found while out looking for wildlife? Well, I mean, the problems have, but what are some of the most memorable to you?
So for wildlife in general.
And herps.
So herping, I think you always find the most beautiful snakes or the strangest snakes when you're not expecting it. And
that is very true. That's very true.
And I never have my camera ready. So there's a story that I had where I was looking for a leopard in St. Lucia. And this is in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And I knew that the leopard was there. And my uncle was the president or the manager of the park. And he told me that if I just go at this time and I go to a certain area, I will definitely see it. And I went up and down there every night for 2 weeks. And I spoke to another person who runs tours. And I went with him every night, and we went for 5 hours every night looking for this leopard. And he just said to me, "I'm so sorry, Rob, but he's always here, but he's not here now." And I never saw it. And then I remember the one night I decided to put my camera just at the bottom of the seat, at the behind my seat, and I wanted to go home. It was too much for me. And just as I was about 100 meters from the house, the leopard popped out onto the road and walked right in front of me and sniffed my car. And I braked so heavily that the camera got stuck underneath the passenger seat. And I had to try and get the camera out, but I couldn't turn the light on because I didn't want to startle the leopard. And I had my windows open, and I didn't want to make any noise whatsoever. So I quickly had to jump into the back seat and grab the camera. And by the time I got the camera out, I had a telephoto lens on, and the leopard was sniffing the mirror right next to me and was looking at me in the face, and then walked around the car and carried on going on its way. And I think I got a photo, but it was so blurry and it was out of focus. So that was a terrible experience, because it was two weeks at least that I was tracking him down and knew exactly where he was, and I missed him every single time. When it comes to herping, I think one of the most memorable experiences would be walking through the desert in Namibia. I think Namibia is probably the most beautiful place that I've ever been to go herping, because it seems like there's nothing. But there's so much going on. There's so much wildlife there. And I remember tracking horned adders in this one river and walking up the riverbed. It's completely dry because there's no water in the summertime. And having a look for horned adders. And then I knew where one was, and I followed the track. And I had a friend who's a tracker with me. And we looked and we looked and we found it. So that was amazing. And then once we found one, we found quite a few. Another species that's really beautiful from there is the Piringues viper or Piringues adder. And they're a sidewinding species. And I remember seeing my first one when I think I was about 14 years old. I was walking through the desert and I was looking for them and I didn't see any. And then after about 5 or 6 days of trying, I think I probably saw about 10 or so in the first day. And then once I knew where they were, it was amazing. Then you just carried on finding more and more and more. So yeah. those are beautiful snakes, and they're so underrated. And there's just these amazing little dwarf adders, tiny little vipers. So for me, those kind of snakes are really incredible. And I'm not so attracted to the big snakes or the highly venomous snakes. I don't mind working with them. It's perfectly fine. But I think unusual snakes are far more interesting to find.
Yeah, I think I feel kind of the same way about that. Well, I still want to find all the big headline species whenever I go out herping. But at the same time, if I find, say, some unique colubrid that's found in this one little pocket, to me, that's a pretty cool find, because not many people know about it. So it's pretty interesting to get to see their kind of natural habitat, natural behavior in the wild.
Yeah. Another cool story that happened quite recently was last year I was in the Amazon, and we were looking for snakes, just going targeting all the snake species that we could find. And we found, yeah, I think the most incredible part about that trip was my friend Axel, who lives in the jungle. He invited me and he says, "You have to come." So I just decided, okay, I'm going. And I went with him, and we went all the way to the border with Peru and Ecuador, about 8 hours or so on boat. And on the first night, we found a bushmaster. And it was right there. It was right in front of us. And we just assumed that that would be a good place because they need what we call in Spanish primary forest. So they need real jungle. It can't have been disturbed by humans. So it has to be in a place where it hasn't been touched ever. There's no agriculture.
All completely growth.
Exactly. It's completely isolated. And we picked a place where we thought this looks like the right habitat. And we found one in about 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And we were all blown away. I think that was really incredible. And funny stories from that trip were on the second to last night, the girl in front of me, we were all walking, and this was at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, we're very tired, we're walking home, there's tons of mosquitoes biting us, and a snake slithered, and I had my headlamp on, and I couldn't really see what it was, and she stood on it, and it was just about a meter long, and I thought it was what they call it, like a false fertilance. So I just grabbed it, and as I grabbed it, I realized, hang on, this is Bothrops atrox. This is a fertilance viper. Mm. I grabbed it kind of to mid body towards the tail, and it was nighttime, and this thing was moving quite quickly. So I grabbed it, looked at it, let it go, grabbed it with my hand, and then I didn't have a hook ready because it was on the back of my bag. And then I tried to jump over all of the shrubs to where it was going, but it went away.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure, because I used to keep them, so I'm pretty sure what it was. So that wasn't good. And on the same trip, we were filming an Amazon basin emerald tree boa, and there were so many mosquitoes, and they were just biting me all over my face. There's a photo I've got where on my back they were everywhere. I just had mosquito bites all over my body. And when I arrived home after being in the Amazon, I felt something growing on my forehead, and I didn't know what it was. And I thought, well, it's growing quite quickly, so if this is a tumor, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble quite fast. So if it's not, it has to be a botfly.
You
can get a botfly larva, which you can get in the Amazon quite easily. And the place that we were visiting was in their language, where, you know, directly translated would be the Lake of Mosquitoes. So, and they transported by mosquitoes. So it was very likely. And it just carried on growing and growing and growing. And then eventually I knew what it was because I could feel it eating away at my flesh every night. And there would be a little trickle of water, like a nice clear liquid that would fall down every night. And then after a few nights of this, I realized it has to be a botfly. And then I got it removed. But it lasted for about 3 weeks before I was 100% sure that it was a botfly. And then it was quite a fun event to have that removed. That's definitely one of my most memorable experiences while herping.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to forget having a insect inside of you just crawling around eating you on from the inside. I never had that happen, thankfully, but probably wouldn't forget if I did.
I didn't know what it was at first. And then every night when I was sleeping, just as I was about to fall asleep, it would start sucking away and start like moving. and going up and down and moving around. And I thought, no, this has to be a botfly larva.
Yeah. It's crazy how they seem. Is it true that they seem to only move around when you're about to go to sleep or sleeping?
Well, that's why I didn't know what it was, because during the daytime, I didn't feel anything. It was just a bump. And I remember round about the same time I went rock climbing and I hit my head on one of the holes at the rock climbing gym. And I hit it really hard in exactly the same place. So for 2 weeks, I thought that this lump on my head was from rock climbing, that I just had hurt myself. And then it didn't ever get a bruise. And it just would move or make it would start to pulse like a vein, like when you get a twitch in your eye. It just felt like a little twitch for a good 2 weeks, 3 weeks. But it would, as you say, it would only really happen when I wasn't moving, when I was in bed. But when I was doing stuff during the daytime, I didn't feel anything different.
Weird. It's almost like, I wonder if they actually pick up on if their hosts are moving or not and decide to hold still while it happens so they don't notice it.
Maybe they know, because if the host finds out, then they might pick it out and then they obviously wouldn't survive.
Yeah, yeah. So are there any places you haven't gone herping yet that you want to?
I would really love to go to the U.S. this time, this year or next year, and just buy a van and just go herping and just go all over the United States, southern United States, go to Florida, go to Arizona, Nevada, California, and just go herping and meet a lot of people that love snakes like me.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely the southern. Well, the thing is, I'm from the United States, obviously. So I've kind of become, how to say this? The North American stuff, it used to not have the same pizzazz that something from another continent or another biome had to be growing up. But the more I get older, the more I talk to people from outside of the United States and, you know, people who just keep a lot of North American stuff, the more I realize just how interesting all the stuff we have here in North America is.
I agree. I think that when I was in Florida, I saw an indigo snake for the first time. And I held an indigo snake. And for me, that was just incredible. And they're so underrated. And then you've got all the milksnake species and all the kingsnake species. And I think a lot of international keepers appreciate them and they really enjoy them. And maybe keepers in the United States appreciate them. But I remember as a kid just really wanting a corn snake and really wanting a Californian king snake. And more than just having one, I wanted to see one. I knew that they existed, but I'd never seen one in real life. And then I remember the first time seeing them and seeing gopher snakes and pine snakes and Western diamondback rattlesnakes and Eastern diamondback rattlesnakes. I was blown away at how beautiful they were. To me, North American snakes are so beautiful. And maybe the people that live there, a lot of people in the United States aren't so educated when it comes to snakes, and the general public doesn't have that appreciation. But I do believe that there's a huge amount of people. I know that there's a huge amount of people that really, really love snakes in the United States. And that's a good thing. And as I say, if we all work hard to educate other people and to give them this appreciation, to show them that they're beautiful, that there's a lot to like about snakes, there's far more to like about them than not like them, then it doesn't matter where you live, if you live in Europe or if you live in Australia, if you live in South Africa or the United States, you can educate the people around you and in your community and get them to love the snakes that live in your area, so that a few years from now, they'll still be there.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that. I have noticed that as I've gotten older, it seems that a lot of the people my generation, my age, maybe a little bit younger, a little bit older, are a lot less afraid of snakes than the older generations. And I'm probably just going to have to chalk that up to all those nature programs that were on television during the early mid-2000s. Probably helped a lot with that.
I think so. I think that a lot of people, a lot of groups on Facebook are doing amazing work. There's the group Snakes of Southern Africa that I post photos and videos on there all the time. And I really enjoy having a look and seeing what other people have posted in the group, what other people have found. And there's some people that are snake experts that are extremely knowledgeable, that are able to identify a huge amount of species instantly and educate the public. And never before has there been a time where you can take a photo with your phone, you can upload it to social media, and or you can upload it to iNaturalist, and you can get a confirmation or that it's not dangerous, or maybe that it is dangerous and what you should do. But you get that peace of mind, and you can find out very quickly that you don't have to kill the snake or you don't have to harm it. And that wasn't the case 20 years ago. So that's a good thing. And as you say, a lot of nature programs, a lot of documentaries have given people more of appreciation of nature just in general. And they can see that it's beautiful. And I think a lot of people don't have an upbringing like a lot of South Africans do, where you're able to see these animals in nature with your own eyes. And that's what makes me want to make videos, so that people want to go out and visit the national parks and the reserves around them and find them and see them with their own eyes.
Yeah. So outside of Snake Heroes, is there any other series you've thought about doing with on wildlife?
There are two other projects that I'm working on at the moment that are secret projects that are related to wildlife, which will be quite exciting. But at the moment, it's Snake Heroes that I'm on social media that I'm doing. And I do these little videos, which are quite fun, which you can watch, called 1 Minute Wildlife Documentaries. And I really like making them. And I've made about 60 or 70 or so of them. And the idea is to give you everything that you should need to know, or that you might want to know about a certain species, not just snakes, all different animals from Southern Africa specifically. And you can learn about that animal in less than 60 seconds. And I think for me, that's been quite a good initiative that I tried, because people really appreciate them and people learn about the animal in 60 seconds. People don't have a lot of attention on social media, and you're competing for their attention. And I also don't want to waste your time. I don't want to waste anyone's time. I know that everyone's busy. Everyone's got their own life. And I would like you to learn a little bit about certain species. And I don't want you to have to go and read an article or watch a 45-minute documentary. I would like you to get interested instantly. And then if you are interested and you would like to watch some other content that I've got, then I've got longer format videos like the Snake Heroes episodes.
Yeah. A lot of people have said negative things about the whole 60-second limitation format. I will say the one really good thing about it, though, is it really forces people to be really good editors and really condense down all the important information into a precise yet consumable package. So,
yeah, and I think that if something's not interesting, then you shouldn't be showing it. Or you're going to try and tailor the content to make it as interesting as possible and attract the attention as quickly as possible. So we talk about, you know, creating a hook, trying to get the people interested as quickly as possible. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because if I can show a video that's an hour long and I show it to 1,000 people, they might go out and teach another 1,000 people what they've learned. That's brilliant. But they might not. And then I've only educated 1,000 people or 100 people or whatever. But if I can show it to 100,000 people, or I can get a video that goes viral and I can get 1 million people to watch the video, they've learned something. And what I found is that a lot of people have their preconceived notions, and people who want to learn will go and seek that information out. And you just have to be creative and spark that interest, and then they'll do the rest of the work for you. You don't have to try so hard. So by creating short little videos, I think that you can reach a lot of people, you can make a difference, and those people will educate other people, because often people will comment and say certain things. And it's funny how the people that follow the page or follow me on YouTube will be the first to quickly tell them what the correct information is. And I'm always for that. If it's done in a kind, considerate way, then that's your job. If you know that something's wrong, you must tell everyone else that that's not the right, that snake's not a black mamba, or that snake's not a rattlesnake. That's everyone's responsibility to make sure that we're spreading the right information about snakes.
Yeah. So picking back off of that, what would be some advice you would give to people who want to start making their own videos about this subject? So most notably me, I guess. I want to learn how to do that a little bit.
So I think everyone has a story to tell, and your story is going to be different to my story. And I've got a lot of friends that do YouTube videos involving snakes, involving keeping snakes or conservation of snakes or all different things. And I always, the best advice I can give you is be yourself. Don't try and copy anyone on social media. And that's so cliche, but I don't watch any reptile videos, snake videos whatsoever. I just don't. And I'll only watch a video if you send it to me and you tell me, hey, Rob, would you like to watch this video? Then I will watch it. But even content from my friends, I simply don't watch. I'm far too concentrated and busy doing what I'm doing to get involved and go and watch other stuff. And also, it just keeps me on my path as a creator, or my path as a wildlife filmmaker, and to create content that is true to me. So the best advice I can give you is do exactly what you feel is the right thing to do. And if you feel that it's not right, or you're not happy with the direction that you are going, then change directions, and it's okay. Some people start off doing one thing and then they do another thing, and it's perfectly fine. And also, don't just do what the audience wants you to do. I see a lot of people that I'm really against free handling and crazy shenanigans on videos and in photos. I think that it just takes us down a different path, and it's time wasted. It's time that person, and a lot of those people are so knowledgeable about snakes and about reptiles, and I've got a huge amount of respect for them. But the moment you do something that plays on people's fears or makes them think that you're cool, I think that you're going away from what your responsibility is as a snake expert or someone that loves snakes, which is to simply make other people love snakes. And then, you know, when you're gone, you'll pass on your knowledge and your information, and they'll pass it on to someone else. So stay true to yourself. Don't do things for the attention. Do it purely because you love it. And whatever you do, if you do something that's about keeping snakes or breeding snakes, if you do it with passion, you'll do it well, and people will learn. And that's what I always say, is that I don't keep snakes anymore. I've got nothing against that, and I think that it's a fundamental part about snake conservation. And there's a lot of people that do it and do it very well, a lot better than I do. So if they teach other people how to do that, and then I can help people to learn about snakes in the wild, that's awesome. But the more people that are teaching other people about reptiles and snakes and wildlife, it's going to push us all in the right direction.
Yeah. So going back to Snake Heroes, Do you have any plans, like a season three or four, like say Snake Heroes Europe or Snake Heroes Australia, so to speak?
Of course. Of course. It's world domination. We have to go everywhere. I can't stop.
Just picking Snake Keepers from every continent, like Thanos with the Infinity Stones.
Exactly. I want to share the stories of the people that I admire that work with snakes. And when we went to Florida, I met some incredible people. And it was amazing to me because I didn't expect to meet some of them. And every single person has been very humble, very friendly, very down to earth. Even some of these people on Facebook, I thought, wow, these people would, maybe this person would be a bit crazy or this or that. In real life, they were really nice people. And I felt compelled to do another Snake Heroes in Florida. I'd love to do one in California or in Arizona and Nevada and go to some beautiful places and carry on doing one in South America and definitely in Europe. I've got a lot of friends there that are doing amazing work, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and I've seen it in videos and photos. And I think that we can do a lot to show people that they're doing good, that there's people that have reptile collections in zoos, that there's a general feeling in the public that zoos are bad and that zoos are not good for the animals, that the animals are unhappy. And a lot of the places that I've visited, I've learned personally so much about snake behavior and about how these keepers interact with their snakes. And I definitely want to go to Europe, and I've got a few friends that I haven't seen anyone else do those things and interact with snakes and with the public with snakes in that way.
Yeah, that's one thing I will say about, like, I just noticed this about a lot of zookeepers is they are very tuned in to the animals they take care of. I mean, it makes sense. They're always taking, they're the ones, basically they're the animal's parent almost, but they're very much tuned in to their animal's behavior, their biology, their nutritional needs, how they behave in different seasons, all that sort of stuff.
Yes, I think that spending time with your animals when you're at home is one thing. And if you live at home, that's, you're going to learn a lot from them. But when you work in a zoo or you work in a reptile collection, you're going to learn far more. And you also get to learn a lot of the questions that the public wants answers to. So if you have a look at all of the best snake experts in South Africa, they've all done time in a snake park. They've all put in their hours. And that's why they're so knowledgeable, because they have a huge amount of knowledge, because they know exactly what questions you're already going to ask, because they've been asked them a million times. And and they're standing there all day with the snakes, with the reptiles. And if anything happens, they've seen it already. So that's one way to learn a lot about snakes. And that's why I'm always for snakes in captivity. And a lot of people who keep snakes in captivity, they feel that they're doing their part for conservation. I don't really believe that. I think that we should do a lot more for the snakes in the wild. There's, pathogens in Florida that are killing snakes as we speak. There are a lot of people that are working hard to raise awareness for it. But in a lot of places, there will not be snakes in the future unless they become resistant against this fungal disease and this lungworm that they have there. So we need to do a lot of work right now to make sure that we have snakes in wild areas and that they are protected in the future.
Yeah. If I say the best way a snake keeper can help with conservation, it's not like, oh, breeding for conservation. It's more, let's like say letting people know more about snakes. My grandmother just asked me to do a snake show at a summer camp this summer. So for the little kids there. So getting out and actually letting people know more about the animals you keep and why they're not dangerous, or why they're actually beneficial, why they're actually good to have around, and just how cool they are. It's probably more helpful as an individual keeper than saying, oh, I'm breeding this species just because I'm breeding it.
Exactly. So in South Africa, there's a lot of snake handling courses and snake awareness courses that people, snake experts provide. And you can go and learn and you can handle venomous snakes. And they call it snake handling boot camp, I think. And you can go
is that,
and...
is that ASI that does it?
Exactly, the African Snake Bite Institute. So that's a friend of mine, Johan Murray, and Ashley Kemp, and they do amazing work. And there's a few other people that also do it in Southern Africa. And I've got another friend called Dean Boshoff, and he does birthday parties for kids. And he takes his snake collection and he shows kids beautiful snakes in a beautiful way. And he's got a nice exhibit and interacts with the public. And when I lived in South Africa, I used to do a lot of snake awareness talks for free for people that wanted to learn about snakes. And you might think that it's silly, or you might think that it's a waste of your time to go and educate people and get told, get asked silly questions to you, you know, about your snakes and your snake collection. But it really makes a difference. And if you do this for a few years, you'll realize it, that that little interaction with a ball python or a corn snake, or seeing something that they perceive to be dangerous and learning that they don't have anything to worry about, that snakes aren't out to get you, the message spreads very quickly, and it spreads to that kid's family and to the grandparents, and it has a snowball effect in that community. And you can see it in places where they don't do snake education, or where the laws don't permit it, where people aren't allowed to take a snake and move it, or they aren't allowed to interact with the snake. You know, in some places it might be easier for them to have permission to kill the snake than it is to relocate the snake. So, and you can see in those places that people don't have that appreciation. And that's something that we need to spread as quickly as possible to as many people as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So outside of snakes, are there any other herps that you like videoing?
Everything. Absolutely everything. So I love, for me, everyone loves lions when they go to Africa. They want to see a lion, and they want to see a leopard, and they want to see elephants, and they want to see all, you know, all the big five. And for me, one of the species that's so beautiful is just the impala, which is just an antelope that you see every single day. They are just so beautiful. They're perfect. You know, they couldn't have made a more perfect antelope species than the impala. And then you get all different species of reptiles that are so unique. And everything that you spend more time filming, you'll realize that they have behaviors that you wouldn't expect. And you see this a lot with snakes, that if you keep them, that especially cobras, for example, if you spend a lot, if you film cobras, they relax very quickly. And you can spend a whole day filming a cobra, and your biggest problem is going to be that cobra won't hood. And that's the case with a lot of cobra species. And this is wild cobras, not even captive cobras. They just get so used to it that once they know that the threat has gone, they just relax. And I think filming snakes I'll often film one snake for a few hours. And I really don't want to stress it out. I just wanted to do its thing and follow it around. And when you do that with all different species, snakes, lizards, mammals, everything, birds, you soon learn that there's a lot of behavior that they purposefully haven't shown you on YouTube or on TV because it's not exciting. And for me, that's really remarkable when you see snakes trying to get ants off them, or you see them smelling things or following a scent trail, and doing their natural behavior. And it might not look good on camera, but for me in the moment, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, last week I just finished recording the previous episode, this podcast, and 20 minutes afterwards, I was just in here, my reptile shed, doing some other stuff. And also I just hear this racket from right over here. And it turns out my gopher snakes decided tonight's the night they were going to start breeding. So it sounded like literally like two squirrels chasing each other in laps around here. It's just these gopher snakes, going around. It's just so interesting to see the male's behavior. The female doesn't seem like she liked it, but the male is pretty interesting to watch.
There's so much you can learn from keeping snakes in captivity, and you can learn so much about behavior. And one of the things that I've noticed when I came to Ecuador was that a lot of people that said that they were snake experts, they knew a lot about snakes, about the different species, but they didn't know much about snake behavior, and they didn't know how to interact with snakes. And so definitely, if you want to learn a lot about snakes, work with snakes. That's the best way. You're going to learn far more from working with snakes in captivity in 1 month than you will going out herping. That being said, going out and seeing snakes in their natural environment is going to teach you far more about the way that they interact with other species and the way that they live in the environment than you'll ever learn from keeping them in captivity, because they get accustomed to a lot of things, and they get accustomed to the way that you keep them specifically in your collection, and your experiences might be slightly different to someone else's experiences in a different collection.
Yeah. That's one thing I've heard from a lot of people who both keep and herp, is that when they find the species in the wild that they keep in captivity, it almost inspires them to change up a little bit how they keep them in captivity, how to change up their enclosure a little bit, or how to change the environment in the room or something like that.
It's very possible. I think that there's also this movement. Well, there used to be a very strong movement to try and create everything as natural as possible. And sometimes when it's done perfectly and you have natural vivaria, then you can recreate an environment and you can stimulate certain behavior, and that's incredible. And there's people that do it well. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't do it well, and it's appealing to the keeper's eyes. And I don't agree with that. I'd far rather people have snakes in a sanitary, simple environment or a simple setup where the snake's happy, than have a pleasant to look at display where the snake isn't doing as well as it could be. So it's a mixture of the two.
Yeah. Well, this podcast is called the Crocast Podcast. So I'm going to ask, have you done any filming work with crocodilians?
I haven't done so much. So last week I was in the Everglades, and in South Africa, we've got the Nile crocodile, and I wouldn't walk up to a Nile crocodile at 3 o'clock in the morning and take a video. But you can do that with alligators, and I think that's so incredible. And every time I go to Florida, the first thing I do is I get in my car and I go to the Everglades and I look for alligators. And just last week, a lot of them are very accustomed to people, and you probably know more about this than I do. But if I was to go down to the river in Kruger National Park, and I was to go and call a gator or call a Nile crocodile, I don't think there's much chance of it coming over. But the moment they see you and the moment you make a sound, they obviously are accustomed to people going there and feeding them, which I don't agree with. But that seems to be the case, because you make a sound and they come over, and they're very accustomed to people. I wouldn't call them tame, but you can get very close to them. And we got in the water with a friend of mine, and it was an amazing experience to see a a male, a huge big male alligator in the wild, in its natural environment. That's absolutely incredible. So I'm really excited, and I would like to go and film more crocodilian species. And I've worked with caimans here in Ecuador, and I filmed a lot of caimans here, because we get, as far as I remember, three different species, and they're fascinating, and they're so intelligent, and it's an intelligence that's not understood, and it's underrated. You see it with a lot of lizard species as well, and with cobra species and python species, just because they don't tick the boxes when it comes to testing intelligence doesn't mean that they're not intelligent. They are absolutely incredible to see in the wild, and they're cunning, they're curious, and I really do love to see crocodilians in the wild.
Yeah, that's one thing I remember reading up on in, I think it was junior high. I was doing for some sort of like science research project in junior high, was on reptile intelligence. And the thing is, a lot of the tests, like say during like the 1960s or so, that said, oh, reptiles are dumb, they're kind of purposely set up to make the reptiles fail, and that they required, you know, puzzle manipulation in a way only a reptile just physically couldn't handle, do with like a hand or something like that, like a rodent could. So that, but now people are kind of I think people now are catching on to, they are a lot more clever than the old stereotype about them.
Yes, I used to have a beautiful big, I think it was 2.25 or 2.3 meters, a forest cobra, a brown forest cobra from South Africa. And he was just incredible to keep and to work with. And he was definitely intelligent. He knew exactly who I was. And he would come up to the glass and see if I had something to eat. And I would take him out. And as I say, I'm very much against free handling. And I would always grab him with a hook and take him out, but he was completely tame. And the only thing that he wanted was a big rat. He had no intention of ever coming towards me or getting or hurting me. And he was very big and very powerful. And every time we used to take him out, he knew exactly what was going on. And I would take him out into the garden and let him smell things and have a look around. And he was a completely relaxed snake. He was very intelligent, and he knew exactly what was going on. So that taught me a lot about a lot of venomous species, and that although they are venomous, they definitely just want to have their meal. They don't want anything to do with humans, and they can get accustomed to working with humans, and you have to have a huge amount of respect. And they don't really care about you. I think that we fall in love with all of our reptiles, but they just want to eat and propagate and be safe. And if you provide that for them, then you can learn a huge amount, and you can interact with them in a positive way. And I really enjoyed keeping that species and learning about how intelligent they were.
Yeah. One guy I had on the podcast a while ago, maybe a year and a half ago. His name's Nathan Frank. He runs a venom lab up in Wisconsin. And he mentioned this with his black mambas. One particular female black mamba is that most of the time she's actually pretty chill. But then the moment she noticed that venom collection tape cart they bring out for when they do a venom collection, she just flip a switch and become the stereotype we have about mambas, just because she obviously didn't like getting milked.
Yeah, I think that a lot of cobra species and mamba species, they're also motivated by food. So if you were to bring out a lot of frozen rats or thawed rats, they're going to get quite excited very quickly. So I remember I used to have a lot of cobra species and a lot of mamba species or individuals. And I used to love to feed them and to see how they're unbelievably fast and accurate, and they're so well adapted to the environment. And that is kind of the reason why I started to think, why am I keeping snakes, and why do I have all these different beautiful snakes in my collection when I could go out and find ones that are in the wild and learn more about them in the wild, and teach people about how they really are, not my interactions in a captive environment. To me, it just felt a bit selfish that I wasn't using my abilities to the best of my ability, using my knowledge to the best of my ability, because if I love them so much, I have to tell everyone else about it.
Yeah. Let's see here, what time is it? Yeah, I'm blanking out on questions at the moment. Is there anything else you want like to talk about?
What else could we talk about?
Oh, speaking of crocodilians in Ecuador, I think you also have American crocodiles on the Pacific coast in some parts. Could be wrong, though.
So we do have the American crocodile, as far as I understand it's called, quite close to where I am, about 3 hours from here. There's a river called the Guayas River, and they do have them there. And then there's another population, as far as I understand, on the coast, a bit further north in Ecuador. So we do have them, and I haven't seen them in the wild here. I've worked with them in captivity, and then I've seen them in the wild in the Everglades in Florida.
Okay. Yeah. And you say you have three species of caiman, so I'm guessing it'd be both Paleosuchus and Specs.
Spectacle caiman, and then is it the black caiman, and what's the other species?
Would it be Schneider smooth front or Cuvier's dwarf?
So smooth fronted, as far as I understand, and then it's the black caiman, and then I think you have another species that is on the coast side of the Andes, as far as I remember.
Okay.
So it's divided by the Andes, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting, crazy to me is back during the Miocene, so prehistoric times, obviously, but before the Andes Mountains was raised up, Northern South America was actually had one of the highest densities of crocodilian species ever documented in the fossil record.
That I did not know.
Yeah, so I think like Colombia, I think like northern Peru and stuff like that, before the Andes raced out, it was all a shallow wetland area that had, I think, like 9-10 plus species of crocodilian, including true crocodiles, caimans, including Brucosaurus, which is like a 40-foot long caiman, basically. Okay. And marine species of gharials as well. So
that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Then no, the Andes are incredible. The Andes are incredible because they've just divided the two populations for, I think it's 20 million years or 25 million years. So you've got Bothrops atrox on the one side, on the eastern side, and then you've got Bothrops asper on the western side, on the coast. And you've got your Bushmaster species that are also kind of divided more northwards. And all the different species that are divided by this mountain range because they've been separated for such a long period of time. But they have adapted, or they haven't changed much, but they're completely different species because they've been isolated for so long, because it's just the Andes are so hard and so cold that it would be impossible for a snake or a lizard or a tortoise to move from the west of the Andes to the east of the Andes or vice versa.
Yeah. Oh, I think about it. Since you are in Ecuador, have you ever done any, ever been to the Galapagos Islands?
I would like to go to the Galapagos Islands in about a month or two. So I've never been. It's quite expensive to go there if you're a tourist, but now I'm a resident here, so it makes it a bit cheaper, and I definitely want to go. I've been putting it off for far too long.
Yeah, that's one of the bucket list places for me that I've wanted to visit before I die, so.
I think that you have to, if you love reptiles, go to Southern Africa, go to Southeast Asia, go to North America, and go to the Amazon. You have to go to the Amazon. It's incredible. And then Galapagos is one of those places where I think everyone wants to go. So it might be overrated. I don't know what it would be like to be there. I know that I'm going to have fun, but there's so many beautiful places to look for reptiles and look for snakes. And I think that you can also appreciate the place that you're from just as much as these exotic destinations. And often, right in your garden, I know it's a bit hard if you live in the northern parts of the United States, but in a lot of places around the world, they've got a lot of wildlife and they don't appreciate it. And that's the biggest problem with deforestation in the Amazon, is that people think about it as this big bulldozer that's going in and it's destroying everything. But it's really not. It's exactly what's going on in Florida. It's people building houses, building farms, destroying a tiny little bit of land collectively. And we all are doing it collectively. We're all responsible. So if we appreciate the places that we're from, if you live in another place around the world and you appreciate the natural area around where you live, and the people in South America do the same, and the people in Africa and the people anywhere appreciate it and conserve it, then it'll snowball and we will all be able to see these amazing reptiles in the future.
Yeah. Well, sounds like a good note to end the episode on. So, before we leave, do you want to tell people where, remind people again where they can find you?
So if you go onto Facebook, I'm Robert Wedderburn Productions. If you would like to watch my Snake Heroes documentaries on YouTube, they're available to watch. I'm Robert Wedderburn on YouTube and on TikTok and Instagram. It's just my name and surname. Once again, Robert Wedderburn. So I'd love for you to have a look at my videos and comment. And I'm always watching. I'm always there seeing what's going on and interacting with everyone. So if you would like to send me a message and a comment, I will most definitely read it. And I look forward to seeing you there.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much, Nate.